Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on June 2, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Sabba Sabba Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches the ending of the mental fermentations through appropriate or refined mindfulness. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So today's talk is on the Sabba Sabba Sutta. I gave this talk on Tuesday evening as well, and that's, you know, if you haven't noticed, that's likely going to be the pattern going forward, that because there almost is two distinct sanghas here, these different groups on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'll likely be teaching the same sutta on both days. Sometimes I'll change it up though. In the, I know I'm talking about the Sabba Sabba Sutta, but there's a related sutta called the Vatupama Sutta, which I'll actually be teaching that in a couple of weeks, where the Buddha describes these fermentations or defilements. He lists 16 of them as greed, ill will, anger, hostility, denigration, domineering, envy, jealousy, hypocrisy, fraud, obstinacy, presumption, conceit, arrogance, vanity, and negligence. And we don't have any of those, do we?
Can I ask a question already?
Sure.
Are there any more, or is that the list of how we identify to ourselves? Is it? I mean, that's how we. That's I'm making, right?
Yes. These fermentations, defilements, are a result of I making.
Yeah.
It's a great question, and so I making is the result of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Again, the solution, the Buddha always pointed out the problem. We talked about this on retreat. He taught often what's called via negativa, which simply means pointing out the problem, which the spiritual systems of his time and even our time, we're not supposed to look at the negative. Everything is supposed to be positive, and that's just an unrealistic view. And so the Buddha, in his great compassion, insisted that we look at the manifestations of ignorance, and how else would we recognize them and abandon them if we weren't willing to look at them? And of course, that's where this great gentleness comes in, because we could judge ourselves harshly. We could think about, oh boy, I'm so domineering, what's wrong with me? The Buddha also taught that these are common human problems, human fermentations. There's no reason to take any of these personal, except to recognize their source so that we can eliminate them. Thank you for the question.
Can you just read them again?
Sure. You sure you want to hear them again? Greed. Ill will. Anger. Hostility. Denigration. Domineering. Envy. Jealousy. Hypocrisy. Fraud. Obstinacy. Which is just another way of protecting wrong views, isn't it? Presumption. Conceit, I'm making, arrogance, all this comes from that, vanity, and negligence. You know, as I'm reading this, the Buddha's pointing this out in a way that there's no denigration in it, is there? He's not saying that we're wrong or bad or immoral or any of those things. He's simply pointing out, via negativa, the results of ignorance. And again, just so we're clear, so we understand what we're dealing with. These were things that the Buddha saw in himself. He wasn't free of these. He freed himself of these. When you read the Nagara Sutta and understand where dependent origination came from, it's because the Buddha recognized these in himself, and by developing profound understanding, he abandoned them through lack of clinging to wrong views. So that your question really gets to the heart of the matter. Those listed, what are called the fetters or the defilements are listed simply as greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. And when you look at those 16, they're all included in that description of the three defilements, aren't they? And so what we're hoping to develop an understanding of is our own greed or desire or craving for continued self-existence. And because of impermanence, we can never get what we want and keep what we want. we create aversions to things that seem to threaten our views of what we need to be comfortable and safe and secure. An extreme word for aversion is hatred. Look what's going on in the world today. There's extreme justification for hatred from all different sides, isn't there? But this was common during the Buddhist time. And all of that, those first two defilements, could be included as deluded thinking, or they wouldn't arise. In the Sabbasava Sutta, the Buddha was at Savatthi in Jita's Grove, Anatha Pindika's monastery. He presented the following teachings. Friends, the ending of the fermentations is for one who knows and understands skillful and unskillful mindfulness. Like we talk a lot about here, every sutta is in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are developed through the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path teaches to develop a well-concentrated mind, holding refined mindfulness. And the reason why I use that term is mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect. We can do that with anything. We can have unskillful mindfulness, still mindfulness, or skillful mindfulness. And the determining factor is what we're holding in mind. If what we're holding in mind is framed by the Eightfold Path, that's where our freedom and the power to live a meaningful life manifests. If what we're holding in mind is our unskillful qualities, and that could even be applied to so-called spiritual teachings, if what we're holding in mind is more of an escaped and continued eye-making, or we could be of two minds, which is even worse, I think, that we're trying to maintain something that an awakened human being taught, but we're unwilling to give up other aspects of our conditioned thinking of what a so-called spiritual practice should be. And the Buddha, remember the series we just went through about what the Buddha taught to and why he taught, it's just as important when you're teaching via negativa to identify what the problem is and what it's not. And that can, ultimately the Buddha is teaching that this refined mindfulness that we develop is developed so that we can be mindful of what is present, what's occurring, but as important, be mindful of what is not present or what's not occurring, meaning continual ignorance. And we have to be able to recognize that. Again, here's the framework. Here's what we should be looking for. And these could also be seen as the five hindrances that we talked about at the end of the last Truth of Happiness course that we went through. Those five hindrances are all aspects of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. So it's a very useful thinking to recognize when the need for sensory indulgence or ill will is present, or doubt and skepticism, when they arise, indifference to these teachings. To recognize they're all aspects of the same thing, of maintaining, you've heard me say this often, and the longer I teach and the longer I experience the brilliance of this Dhamma, the more I see this subtle but powerful strategies that we all create in our minds to continue to ignore ignorance. And once they're established in our minds, it's very easy to justify it, isn't it? Usually that only because I feel this way or I think this way, and that's justification enough. So we need a framework in order to see these fermentations. The Buddha continues, the ending of the fermentations is not possible by one who does not know or understand skillful and unskillful mindfulness. When one is inappropriately mindful, fermentations arise and increase. So if the fermentations are arising and increasing, we know that we are engaging in unskillful or unrefined mindfulness. When one is skillful, how do we know that? The Buddha says, when one is skillful in their application of mindfulness, additional fermentations do not arise and present fermentations are abandoned. Again, a simple and direct teaching. Friends, take my glasses off in order to see. Friends, there are seven ways to abandon fermentations. This is just great instructions. There are fermentations that are to be abandoned by understanding, meaning simply developing right view. In one lacking instruction of the Eightfold Path, and having no regard for the Dhamma or for those of integrity, meaning those that have integrated the Dhamma, this one cannot discern what is skillful to be mindful of and what is unskillful to hold in mind. Why? They are, my rhetorical question, they are lacking the framework for clear knowing provided by the Eightfold Path. So again, the Buddha is giving these simple but continual teachings and reference back to the path to extricate ourselves from wrong views or unskillful mindfulness. Again, just a very clear and direct and most compassionate teaching. And you know, I want to say something here, and I'll probably talk about it a little bit more in depth at one class, because this comes up from, it comes up often, mostly from online students that aren't experiencing this. But Liz brought this up last Tuesday about sometimes these feelings, these teachings seem dogmatic. And you know, she understands the difference because she's had the experience, and that's so important. Dogmatic teachings, dogmatism, if I can put the ism on it, is expressing something from an authoritative point of view. I know what it is, but lacking foundation. That's the definition of dogma. And so, again, without beating anything up, that points to faith-based teachings. The Buddha didn't teach anything dogmatic because everything that he taught was to be experienced, and the foundation for the authenticity or the authority is our own experience, not someone saying this is how you should be, and if you act this way you'll get this. The foundation is in the Dhamma, so there's nothing dogmatic about it. You either take it or leave it, and if you want to use those types of views, that's fine, but there's a significant difference. And again, the Buddha doesn't leave us hanging, saying you should be good people, you should be compassionate, you shouldn't lie, you shouldn't drink, you shouldn't engage in this or that. In fact, he pointed those things out as guidelines for someone who's developing awakening, because you can't act in that way. But it also points to the middle factors of the Eightfold Path of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. We have a direct experience of the Dhamma. We don't take anything on faith.
He also said, Kopasiko, try it for yourself.
Kopasiko, come and see for yourself.
Yeah.
And that was, thank you, that was his, not that the Buddha ever used mantras, but that was his mantra. Mm-hmm. If you're going to experience this, don't take the teachings to the Kalamas, one of the, again, most misunderstood suttas. The Buddha says, don't take it on my word, because you don't have to, because he knew that that's not a useful understanding by just saying I'm going to follow the Buddha blindly, because he never taught that. He wasn't trying to gather worshipers. He didn't teach a salvific religion. He never hauled himself out as a savior. He simply says, I figured some things out that are very important for humanity. Do this and you'll attain the same understanding. And that's his Dhamma. Never once did he say anything to take it on faith or follow him blindly. And he always pointed back to the path that we can develop refined mindfulness and develop the foundation in our own lives, integrate the Eightfold Path as a foundation for awakening. The Buddha continues. And so I'm very grateful that Liz brought that up, because it does come up often. I think a lot of us have probably felt that way at different times and maybe didn't voice that concern, or we might not even be fully aware of it. But we've all developed, I shouldn't say we all, many of us who have come up through the modern religious practices develop a conditioned aversion to anything that might seem dogmatic, even if we're not applying those terms to it. The Buddha knew that during his time, his lifetime too, and another reason why he taught like this. Excuse me. The Buddha continues, and what are ideas that are unskillful to be mindful of? Whatever ideas that, when held in mind, develop sensual craving or increase sensual craving. Makes sense, going back to the hindrances also. Through unskillful sensual craving, establishment of self-craving develops. It continues and it increases. When sensual craving increases, ignorance does as well. When we constantly are giving in to what our feelings and our thoughts rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths drive us to, where we can only increase ignorance. And that's why I say that we create very subtle and powerful strategies to continue to ignore our own ignorance. It's the only way to maintain ignorance, isn't it, when you think about it? These are ideas that are to be mindfully recognized and mindfully abandoned. And what are ideas to be appropriately mindful of? Any ideas that do not develop sensual craving or increase sensual craving. Appropriate or right mindfulness releases any sensual craving that has developed and no establishment of craving for a self arises, and the fermentation of ignorance is abandoned. The Buddha is describing the initial fermentation that begins all of this as ignorance. Remember, dependent origination states from ignorance. Ignorance leads to mental fabrications, part of these fermentations, which through 12 observable causative links ultimately leads to all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering. And it's something else that Jen brought up on retreat with Kevin, that this process of dependent origination happens, I think the word that you used was simultaneously. Kevin, it's a brilliant insight, because it's not something that, it's something that happens outside of time, because it's not something that we can observe, at least not with a very, very well concentrated mind. We can't really observe going from ignorance through each one of the 12 links resulting in suffering. But what we can observe is individual links that have arisen in our minds. But this process, once ignorance has taken place in a human mind, this is just how the mind works, it will do anything to continue to establish that ignorance. And that the dependent origination goes through those steps, but it does occur simultaneously. Once ignorance is present in our minds, simultaneously, instantly, we are prone towards confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. Awakening occurs in just the same way. Now, there's a process getting to that point of simultaneously shedding the dependent origination, shedding the results of ignorance. And so when we can unlink any one of those chains, say craving or even mental fabrications, if we can recognize and abandon any one of those aspects of dependent origination, the metaphor of the chain just falls apart. And so even though it might take a long time, a lot of effort to eventually awakening, that process of going from a deluded mind to an awakened mind happens simultaneously within the framework of the Dhamma and within our own minds. This awakening occurs when a mind is united in its body and is able to be mindfully present, skillfully mindfully present of what's occurring. That's an awakened mind. It's a fully mature mind.
Can I just ask,
please?
The Buddha in this sutta, is he describing the five clinging aggregates in action?
Yeah, boy, another great question.
Yeah.
So I'm going to chastise you for what you said before. You've learned, you really, Lordy, again, I'm not giving to hyperbole. You've learned so much of the Dhamma because you're able to see it in the references to different aspects of the teaching. So yes, the Buddha is describing the ongoing personal experience of suffering and the cause of suffering, and he described that as the self is five clinging aggregates. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing consciousness, meaning thinking rooted in ignorance. That's what we are as we're traveling this road of dukkha. We're five
like
clinging
the term,
aggregates.
Fermentation, because that's sometimes what it feels like I'm stewing in anger.
Yeah. And
it's
isn't that,
you know, cooking up in there and expressing with steams and energies that
yes, and we are fermenting. I'll use an extreme. We're fermenting our own rotten life, meaning the experiences that are rooted in that. Of course, the word fermentations is taken from the, I wish I could remember the Pali word. But it certainly describes what's occurring within ourselves, isn't it? But it doesn't leave us there. Again, via negativa, the Buddha's pointing out, you've created these fermentations yourself. But you can crack the lid on the jar and let it out. You can throw the whole mass of fermented stuff out by simple, skillful mindfulness, refined mindfulness. Kevin?
John, you mentioned earlier that the strategies that are created subtly, and it's almost as if you can see in this sutta, the fermentations and the strategies to maintain ignorance, they can even be turned back on yourself. And this comes into the self-talk almost.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The fermentations kind of can be, you know, there's a strategy to even bring them back on yourself, you know, because you can have all these things, these ill wills towards yourself and say, well, I'm not, you know, I'm not, I just, I just seen that and noticed that.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing that up. And really, all of these fermentations, all of these defilements, are a reflection of how we think of ourselves.
Mm.
Every one of them. Mm. How often do we, another reason why we need to be very gentle, we harbor ill will against towards ourselves. You know, another minor variation of that is denigration. I'm just not good enough to do this. Maybe I don't deserve to awaken. Or how can I do this? I see other people doing this, but I'm not getting it. Well, think about the difference between Kandana and Ananda. Kandana got it at the first sermon the Buddha ever gave. Ananda didn't ultimately get it until a month after the Buddha passed. And it was really great frustration and urgency at that point that he finally got it. Now, Ananda developed great understanding, so much so that he, probably for the last 25 years of his life, he was teaching prior to having what would be described as arahantship. He had a great understanding of the Dhamma and so was able to do so. But it's all that, and that this is what, it's the unwillingness to recognize these. And one of the great strategies that we use to not recognize it is to blame ourselves for simply having a common human condition. It's almost like catching the cold because we've been hanging around with too many school kids or something, and blaming ourselves for getting the cold. Well, maybe you could have done something different and isolated yourself, but you have to live in the world. And as a consequence of living in the world, we're prone to the germs of the world.
Mm.
That's what happens, Anthony.
Oftentimes when we take abuse from other people, it's because we have a low opinion of ourselves. Or if we're striving for recognition and rewards and things, we may also have a low opinion of ourselves.
Yeah.
It plays in a lot.
Thank you. That's such a subtle aspect of how we set ourselves up for suffering, or creating a scenario in our minds that no matter what position I have, I need to be above this position. I have to have more of this and more of that, because we're stuck in that view, because we're holding this out to the world. This is who I am. We're basing our identity on things that are completely impermanent and totally irrelevant. And that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with living a comfortable life. The problem becomes when we self-identify to it. That's all. And that leads to all these fermentations. Thank you, Anthony. These are ideas that are unskillful to hold in mind. You remember the series we just went through about the great existential questions and how the Buddha addressed those. He brings them up here in this sutta. But really, all of these great existential questions can be boiled down to why me and what's going to happen to me. The Buddha says, did I exist in the past? Did I not exist in the past? Again, look at the craving for self-establishment. What difference does it make, ultimately, to what's occurring now, if I existed in the past or where I'm or what happened? Will I exist in the future? Will I not exist in the future? What am I now? What am I not? Those are all those questions about nothingness and emptiness and what happens to us after we might die, and do I exist in the future? Remember when we talked about Vajragoda, Malankyaputta, and Anuruddha asking basically the same questions, because they're concerned about what's going to happen to them in the future. And in those three cases, they're concerned in a very subtle way about what's going to happen to them if they recognize and abandon all self-referential views, which is really a common fear that we all have when we start coming to realization of the implications of what we're doing here. I think almost every one of you and many, many people here and online have come up against that. It feels like annihilation, doesn't it? Well, that feeling of annihilation comes from hoping that to establish yourself in the future rather than establish yourself right here, right now, which is what the Buddha refused to answer these questions, not because he didn't know. He didn't want to continue the speculation rooted in ignorance. He pointed our minds back to the Eightfold Path. Bring your mind into your body, and in that way, you can be mindful of what's occurring. It's the only way we can experience life. It's the only way life is meaningful, isn't it? To actually be experiencing it as it occurs. Not through a wrong view that is stuck in the past or the future. He concludes that with saying, where have I come from? Holding in mind these unskillful ideas, six confused and deluded views will arise. The view that I have a self, meaning a permanent self, is established. The view that I have no self is established, meaning nothingness or emptiness. And most of modern Buddhism teaches that we are aspiring to a state of nothingness or emptiness, where there's no such thing as a self. Of course, that's all you have to do is listen to or read or understand the basic teachings of the Buddha, and you realize that's just a completely, it's another completely deluded view. The Buddha teaches that another wrong view is I have a self because I perceive a self. That great saying from, I can't think of it.
Descartes?
Was
it Descartes?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think
therefore I am. How long has that been a mantra of humanity? To hang on to ignorance. Just because I have, it's the essence of what the Buddha taught as wrong thinking. Simply because I'm having a thought proves that it's a useful thought that I should hang on to. The Buddha's teaching that if your ongoing thinking is rooted in ignorance, then your ongoing thinking can only develop these wrong views, no matter how brilliant you might think your thinking is, such as that. I have a self because I perceive that I am not a self, which is, think about that saying, that's just simply confused and discursive thinking that the Buddha described in the Nagara Sutta, how he described his awakening. We get stuck in this whirlwind of wrong views bouncing off of wrong thinking. And it seems reasonable to even hold this view in a mind. Well, because I can't reconcile whether I exist or don't exist, then simple reason, rooted in ignorance, I must conclude that I both exist and don't exist. That's what one of the great Mahayana teachers, Nagarjuna, built his whole reputation on, reconciling everything down to that thought. We both exist, and we both not exist, and we both not exist. We not exist at the same time. Again, he built his career. He still, and I read his books. There, he was alive around 600 A.D., maybe 500 A.D. And if you get into his thinking, they're absorbing to a mind like mine that wants to know. But they'll rip your mind to shreds because they take it to places that have no basis in reality, but the way they're presented seems logical. But he used extreme logic rooted in ignorance. So he must have been an incredibly brilliant man to come up with these theories in his own mind, but they lead all the right back to what the Buddha said is foolish or unskillful mindfulness. 5. I am not a self because I perceive a self. That's more confused and discursive thinking. I am constant, everlasting, eternal, never changing. Again, the Buddha teaches that we're always in a process of becoming. There's nothing eternal. But because we can't reconcile any of these other views that the Buddha is describing here, we come to that conclusion. Well, then I just must be permanent. I must last forever. That's also called the materialistic and sometimes a humanistic viewpoint. Humanistic has taken on different terms now, but what that means and what that usually leads to is taking license to do anything you want because you only get this one life and there's no other consequences. This is where religion can often have a positive effect, even though it may lead to deluded thinking. At least you might control your behavior a little bit. You follow the Ten Commandments. You know, maybe one of the reasons why we use them, we engage in religion so often, because at least it's an outer way of controlling something that we're not able to control ourselves. Ultimately, that leads to more deluded thinking, doesn't it? Because we can control ourselves, we can control our thinking, and so control our behavior by developing refined mindfulness. The Buddha then says, this is a thicket of views that binds one to endless confusion, delusion, and suffering, that binds one to endless dukkha. That thicket of views is what I'm referring to when I talk about these powerful and subtle strategies that we use to ignore our own ignorance. We just get caught in this thicket of views that the Buddha used that term often, of falling into these. One who is well instructed in the Dhamma, who has developed the Eightfold Path, who has high regard for the Dhamma and those with integrity in regards to the Dhamma, discerns what ideas are skillful to be mindful of and are to be cultivated, and what ideas are unskillful to be mindful of and are to be simply abandoned. This one remains mindful of skillful qualities and remains free of unskillful qualities. Having developed the refined mindfulness framed by the Eightfold Path, they remain mindful of, so there's going to be a quick quiz right after I say this. They remain mindful of, this is stress. This is the origination of stress. This is the cessation of stress. And the Eightfold Path is a path developing the cessation of stress. What's the reference to? Yeah! With, again, turning everything back to developing understanding, ending ignorance of Four Noble Truths by developing wisdom, understanding of Four Noble Truths. With this refined mindfulness, the fermentations of identity view, self-referential or I-making views, confusion and gripping after and clinging to unskillful precepts and rituals. These are fermentations that are directly abandoned by right understanding or right view. There are fermentations that are to be abandoned by restraint. We talked about the practicing restraint at contact. When we find ourselves getting disturbed or caught back up in the world again, to simply recognize, what's the one thought that conduces towards awakening always?
This is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am.
Yes. That when we find ourselves caught up in the world again, feeling that tension or frustration or maybe an agitated type of elation, to realize and remind ourselves, wait a minute, this is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. And it frees yourself from clinging immediately. It, we talked about it. It cuts at the root of ignorance. Please.
You just described how we think when we're getting into whatever we're getting into. That you didn't put pleasure in there. It's pleasurable to think of yourself as someone, and it gives you the self-esteem or I don't know what it is, but it's also pleasurable.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. It is.
That's the hook that I get caught up in, because I think I get pleasure out of thinking that I am somebody or whatever. It's pleasurable to me.
Yeah, and so that's the first fermentation, defilement, the first hindrance, is the need for sensory stimulation. That's what that means. The need to always feel something pleasurable. And why do I need to do that? Because I've established myself as someone that needs something. And it can be different for everyone. You know, for me, for many years, that's something that I needed to be happy and content was 2 or 3 bottles of vodka every day. I was fulfilling my desire, wasn't it? And it almost killed me. The justification for that in this my deluded thinking was, it makes me feel good. Forget the consequences that were right in front of me, right from the first drink I ever took at 12 years old. There were harsh consequences. But because it gave me something that I thought I needed to survive in the world, I could continually justify it.
Yeah.
Almost to the point of killing, literally, physical death. And most addicts die because they think they need to feel that way. That's an extreme example of clinging to experience, this need for sensory stimulation. And so the trap then is, well, it makes me feel good, it must be okay to continue.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that we can't feel, an awakened human being feels what's appropriate when it's appropriate to feel. So they might be inspired by a great sunset or the smell of a little baby. That always gets me. Or if there's someone that can indulge without going to extreme, they might enjoy, unless you're concerned about intoxication, you might enjoy a glass of wine or a piece of chocolate cake or a wonderful sexual encounter or go on and on, or a great golf shot. But you're not creating an identity over it. It's not something that you need more of. You simply are mindful of what's occurring in your life, and you're able to experience it to the depths of the experience, rather than being distracted by needing more of it or less of it. So, and consequently, when something that is less than pleasurable becomes part of our experience, we recognize that that's temporary too, and we don't need it to be any different. Which is that last instruction that I give. It's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. We gain the ability to be at peace with less than peaceful mind states because we understand the impermanent nature, and we understand that we are always in the process of becoming. becoming either, and that's where one thought can lead in two different directions. If that thought is grounded in the framework of the Eightfold Path, then that thought will incline towards awakening. If not, it inclines towards further ignorance. So thank you for bringing that up. It's great insight. That's the trap, isn't it? It makes me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't I do it?
Mm-hmm.
And we can. You know, we can, you know, what's the extreme, extreme word would be engaging in hedonism. We do all these things because they make me feel good,
mm-hmm.
and that's justification enough. So there's minor experience of hedonism and major experiences, extreme. With the refined mindfulness developed through the framework of the Eightfold Path, this one remains restrained and not distracted by contact with the eyes or the nose or the tongue or the ear or the body or the intellect. The fermentations that would arise in those unrestrained at the six senses do not arise in one who has developed restraint. That's such a that word is not a word that a self-referential ego self wants to hear, does it? A self-referential anatta, the five clinging aggregates, needs to constantly be grasping after fulfilling what it thinks it needs to be happy. And that is a bottomless pit. An ego is never satisfied with what it has. It always wants more. Why? Because it always needs to establish itself in the next moment. And so once we're caught in the need for sensory fulfillment constantly, it's always more. It's always another bottle of vodka or another great golf shot, whatever it is we might need to keep us happy.
It could just be distraction, though, too. I mean, underlying all that, you know, it's just staying busy all the time or having to be planning everything or having to have things so structured.
Yep.
Instead of
every moment of your life.
Like you said, you know, oftentimes the Dhamma practice and Shamatha Vipassana provides you more time to do things with focus. But if you're not focused, you're just running around, filling your day with all this stuff, driving here, driving there, calling this person, doing all these different tasks. And we have to do our tasks in this world, but I feel that the majority of people, you know, not to use the word in a bad sense, but base people are just literally running around in a wheel, just going through motions. It seems like that's 99.9% of humanity. It's just waking up, packing as much into a day, doing it all over again, and just it's you know, I don't want, it's sad. It really
it is sad.
It's troubling. It really is that's what life appears is just, you know, bam, and then you know it's and then you've missed, you know, like the song said, Pink Floyd, 10 years of going behind, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's just where did it go?
Yeah, your life is
in distraction.
You spend your life in endless pursuit of sensory indulgence.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that is the ultimate expression of ignorance, isn't it? That we need to always be doing something. We need to fill our days constantly. Why? Because I got to take care of my ego. This is all I get, and I can't get enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest hindrance or problem that I hear from, you know, a lot of my students, the difficulty in establishing this practice is they're just too busy. But think about that. We should have, as adult beings, we don't have enough control of our thinking and our actions to realize that maybe 5 or 10 minutes of meditation might be helpful. We can't even go that far because we're just too busy. That constant need for sensory indulgence.
And then there's no reference point back to anatta. There's no achievement or no acquisition. There doesn't seem to be anything that goes on that timeline of ignorance. Ignorance has this acquire, achieve, boom, boom, boom. You look back at those 10 years, well, it was all distraction, but I achieved this and marked it here. Here's the things I did.
Yeah.
Here's what I did. Here's what I'm holding out to the world. Here's what I achieved. All this stuff, this pile of whatever.
Yeah. And what's that phrase? You can't take it with you. But yet, most of us want to do that. You know, and that's really one of the big concerns about ultimate death, isn't it? What am I going to do with all the stuff? I can't. You know, there's a lot of stress there. That constant grasping is what the Buddha identified in the Second Noble Truth. Grasping or craving originates, and clinging perpetuates suffering. Takes us right back to it. How do we let it, and it's the most difficult thing to do initially.
Yeah.
To even squeeze in 5 minutes of meditation and consider, just to consider that maybe my view is a wrong view and let me try to develop right view.
Strategy is it's just perpetuating it. It can't be that.
It can't be
sitting for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
No way that's where it is.
I'm
going to go out and look for the million other things that it could be.
Yeah.
But it's never going to be, it's not going to be that because I'm, you know, the ignorance is working there.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Not, it's
that's
not sitting on my cushion coming to this. It's not this place in Frenchtown. That's not where it is. It's out from some guy, you know,
yeah.
with a book and eating, you know.
Yeah, or magic, you know,
yeah,
or anything, any miraculous type of teaching, rather than just taken to the Dhamma. But
right.
again, there's the hindrances, the doubt, the skepticism, the indifference. And those are all subtle strategies that we use to continue our own ignorance. And they work for most of us. You know, that's why I used to say this more often, and maybe I'll start again, that this is a practice of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart. You know, if we're really developing the Dhamma wholeheartedly, another reason why we need to be gentle, because every moment we're coming up against our wrong views. And we have to take a breath, remind ourselves that this is not me, this is not mine, and that awakening, developing full human maturity, is possible in this lifetime. All that we have to do is to continue to engage with that sixth factor, the Eightfold Path of right effort. The fermentations that would arise in those unrestrained at the six senses do not arise in one who has developed restraint. Simple and direct, and it's an act of gentleness to engage in that type of mindfulness, isn't it? Number three, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by proper use of what is necessary without creating an identity view from using this. That means I'm following the Buddha. I think I'm the best one following, or I'm the most knowledgeable one. Of course, the Buddha never held himself out as even that. He just simply said, I'm the guy to figure this out first, and so I'm teaching you. Never separated himself in any way or elevated himself other than that distinction, which is an important distinction. This one uses a robe solely for protection and modesty. This one uses food not for entertainment or for intoxication or for growing large or for beautification, but simply for the survival and continuation of the body so that the Eightfold Path can be fully developed. We need to take care of ourselves physically as well, but with that intention, so that I am able and not distracted by bodily fabrications, so I'm able to develop Dhamma. This one uses lodging solely for protection and the enjoyment of seclusion. This one uses medicine for the purpose of curing sickness and to be free of pain and disease. The Buddha said that every human being needs four things. We need food, shelter, medicine, and clothing. He didn't say, remember, he lived a life as an ascetic for 6 years too. He didn't say that we should deny ourselves all of those things too, because that just leads to more eye-making. But we shouldn't create identity over the things that we need to have a human life. The fermentations of unskillful using, meaning creating an identity from what is used, are abandoned simply by skillful using. We have to, the Buddha is recognizing, this is why I say that the Eightfold Path allows us to be human beings while we develop full maturity as human beings. We live in the world, but we're no longer attached to the world. There are fermentations that are to be abandoned by tolerating, meaning just having patience, understanding that this is what's occurring. Impermanence will change everything. Take a breath and come back to what's occurring. One who tolerates, one who abandons reaction to worldly causes and conditions, such as cold or heat or wind or harsh words or unpleasant sensations or nagging insects, that's quite a list, I would say, are current political climates, will not give rise to fermentations and remain free of fermentations by tolerating what is occurring. But it also means that if you find yourself sitting and there's a swarm of bees around you, what do? Take a little walk. Take a mindful walk where there's no more bees. If you're determined on being the best and most mindful Buddhist, you'll sit there and get stung to death, won't you? Out of a wrong using of the Dhamma. Five, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by avoiding. One who mindfully avoids sitting in unsuitable seats, prone to distraction or eye-making. This one avoids sitting with wild or harmful animals, sitting in brambles, or sitting in a cesspool, or other unsuitable habits. He's also, by extension, if you Buddha's always cautioning about choosing our associations wisely, sitting with people that are practicing something using a Dhamma or a Dharma in an unskillful way. That's another aspect of unskillful using. This one avoids association with unskillful people. This one avoids fermentations by avoiding what is skillful to avoid. We simply know. And again, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't have any experience except coming here, but understand the and not create clinging by what we're engaged with in the world. So we might go to a Tibetan monastery to see what's occurring there. Nothing wrong with that, especially if you're looking to educate yourself about the differences in the Dhamma or some other practice. We might engage in something that is not completely compatible with our Dhamma practice, but we find it physically invigorating. That's fine. Understand that it's not Dhamma practice. Instead of that compulsive need to make everything, now that I'm a Dhamma practitioner, everything I do is part of that. The Buddha said to be mindful that of that, or that's unskillful using. This one abandons hurtful thoughts, words, and deeds, and eliminates these from their existence. Number seven, there are fermentations that are to be abandoned by developing the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. With the refined mindfulness developed through the Eightfold Path, they remain mindful of awakening, dependent on seclusion, on dispassion, on cessation, on release from clinging to wrong views. They develop an understanding of the qualities of persistence, inspiration, serenity, concentration, and equanimity as factors of awakening. Remember we talked about in the Truth of Happiness course, in the book Becoming Buddha, and often here, the seven factors of awakening, mentioned in the Satipatthana and the Anapanasati Sutta as central application of skillful using, rooted in concentration and framed by the Eightfold Path. Having developed this understanding through the Eightfold Path, the fermentations are abandoned. When a Dhamma practitioner has abandoned the fermentation through understanding, through restraint, through proper using, through tolerating, through avoiding, through destroying and developing, this one has severed all craving and clinging and has ended all fetters through right understanding and right understanding of conceit and of eye-making. This one has ended all confusion, delusion, and unsatisfactory experiences. That's the end of the sutta. Thank you. Quite a useful sutta, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Any questions related to the sutta? And we'll go around the room. It's nice to see you all got it. Joanna, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here and see everyone. I don't think I have much to say this morning.
You said a lot.
I brought a lot. I said as I was going along, so.
Yeah, thank you
I'll
for that.
I'll sit in noble silence.
Thank you. Anthony, good to see you.
Great talk. I just was thinking through it, like, there's so many tipping points in our lives, it's hard to figure out where you should end relationships with people that are unskillful,
mm-hmm.
and where you should be more tolerant
mm-hmm.
and nurture something that you've had your whole life. Or like, you know, with striving. There's a very fine tipping point between healthy striving and unhealthy striving.
Yeah, that's right.
And it reminds me of what Obama was saying when he was running for re-election, that we need to go at the economy with a scalpel, you know? You kind of need to go at those tipping points with a scalpel
yeah.
because there's such a fine line between something that's healthy and unhealthy.
Yeah,
and I think
right.
you could do a whole course on it.
You
know, like
you could.
How you recognize those things, because
that's
I'm always struggling with those very intense questions.
So the Buddha taught to integrate an Eightfold Path to know how to apply the scalpel. Because when we're engaged in something that's giving rise an unskillful or potentially unskillful relationship, is it drawing us towards wrong speech, wrong action, or wrong livelihood? Is it drawing us towards wrong view? Is it encouraging wrong intention? Is it distracting? That's the tipping point. That's how we apply the scalpel. Of course, we have to develop a measure of concentration and refined mindfulness to do that. But you're right, that's exactly what he's talking about here. And it doesn't mean we'll always be able to apply skillful mindfulness. But even that part, that is part of the process of learning how to apply this the way an awakened human being would ultimately do. And that does become, when we get into the subtle points of this, it gets pretty fine. Another reason why we need to be very gentle, because we're not always going to get it right, are we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's the opportunity. And in getting it wrong is the opportunity for teaching. One of the things that I just loved that Valerie Jarrett said, the woman that was...
Oh, yeah.
She didn't... You know, who knows what she said to her friends, and I'm sure she needed to vent a little bit. In public, she said, this is such a great opportunity to learn, which is what it is. Instead of hating Roseanne and hating the situation, she came, said, let's learn from this. Let's find that scalpel and find the that cutting edge that separates us from mindful thinking and hateful thinking.
Wow. That's another tipping point, though. Like, how?
It is.
Because
a person on this, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
A person on, again, sorry, a person on the same panel said, we need to hate her and hate all these people and all that. Here's this woman that was attacked who ended up being the voice of reason. I mean, it was remarkable what she said. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm just going to say, if you're being relentlessly attacked, I could see the justification in saying, well, you know what? That a bully needs to be confronted with this and needs to be put in their place, as opposed to coming at it from a very mindful standpoint and just using it as a learning opportunity. You know, I mean, sometimes you got to fight fire with fire. I'm thinking of Donald Trump, but it could be applied to anybody.
Yes, it certainly could be. The right speech guides this too, though. And an aspect of right speech is what I'm saying right now necessary, and will it fall on receptive or deaf ears? And if the answer is I know that it's going to fall on deaf ears, it's wrong speech to continue to engage in that. And think about it, using Valerie Jarrett as an example. Imagine what would happen if she sought out Roseanne or anybody else that might say those things about her and demanded that they be something different than they're capable of. You know, I got to say, when I hear something like that, my second thought, besides, you know, why would any human being say this? I know why they say it, out of ignorance. That leads to concern for this woman, for Roseanne's mental health. This is a woman stuck in ignorance that is causing great suffering for her. We should be able to see clearly and have compassion for her. And I think this is, Valerie Jarrett understood this, maybe not in Buddhist terms, but that's why she could see it. It's an opportunity for learning rather than continued confrontation. So the best example that we can give for the bullies and the racists and all the other deluded people is not direct confrontation, but to do what the Buddha did, to sit and be an example of what an awakened, fully mature human being is, and to maybe use these opportunities for a lesson. Now, it doesn't mean that we should, if we're directly engaged with someone who's abusive, it's like a guy asked me on a first retreat, he wasn't getting the idea of not self. He thought that there's no such thing as a self and we shouldn't have any feelings or emotions or never make decisions. He said, well, what do you do when a train's coming at you? You take 2 steps to the left or to the right.
Or four.
when an aggressive person rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths is in our face, it's often best to take 2 steps to the left and continue walking. Because in that instant, the wisdom shows us that we're not going to be able to have any true effect except to continue the confrontation. But again, it's a fine line. We have to have the wisdom to know, can I reach this person? And often, I don't want to get into the...
But is it appropriate to point out hypocrisy?
Yeah, and we can do that in skillful or unskillful ways. We can do it out of anger or be an example of someone who is not hypocritical. So it's hypocritical to rage against hate by more hate. Or to rage against, you know, a mile away, to rage against aversion with more aversion. But what's the saying? Hate doesn't end hatred. But compassion lacking wisdom often continues. Look at the Crusades. There were the Christians engaged in the Crusades out of compassion that was completely misguided. They thought they were saving souls, didn't they? And look at the the awful suffering. So again, if we're using an ideology that has no foundation, dogma, like I talked about, a dogmatic response, we're only continuing suffering in the world, no matter how altruistic our intention might be. So again, the scalpel, we need to have developed wisdom to go with our natural compassion. And I just use that Valerie Jarrett as a great example of that. So thank you for bringing up another great point, Anthony. So, was there anything else you'd like to say?
No.
I think I interrupted you twice during that.
Yeah, there's nothing.
No, thank you. Jen, good to see you.
Good to see you. So I was just thinking about what you guys were talking about in terms of the with the time, you're looking back on what something that happened, like the Roseanne thing,
yeah.
or you're coming up with different scenarios of what could happen. Well, sure, any response is appropriate because none of that's happened yet.
Yeah.
So you don't really know what response would be appropriate until it starts happening.
Yeah.
So anything that you come up with could be totally appropriate because there's an infinite number of possible things that could happen.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
and none of them are happening.
So it goes back to the idea that trying to establish what is an appropriate reaction is on a top. Really, what you need to do is practice mindfulness so that when things come up, you will respond appropriately.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you. That's the teachings on awakened human beings.
So that kind of got me thinking about there was this other thing that I was thinking about when you were talking about the fermentations, and kind of the other thing that Anthony was talking about. I can't remember exactly how you said it, but it made me think of it. How your a lot of these fermentations sound like they're in aspect to other humans or like in relationship.
Yeah.
Like hostility. I mean, you can have hostility toward yourself, but also with other people, anger, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And again, it kind of, the question came up you might be dealing with a fermentation in yourself, but you might also be dealing with fermentation from somebody else. See anger in someone and you could respond with that, or you could react to that with more anger, or you could recognize that they're in an ignorant place right now and just respond to it that way.
Yes.
From that place is kind of what I was thinking about. And so that was, because it is always like Anthony was saying, like, how do you know when to do one thing versus another thing, and how do you, we are always in relationship.
Yeah.
Humans are in relationship.
Yep.
To each other, and that's like, that adds a whole like exponential complication.
Yeah.
To
That's why the behavioral aspects of the Eightfold Path are there, because we are in constant relationship with others and with ourselves, and that's how skillful or unskillful behavior manifests through right speech, action, or livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we can hold that in mind, it's a teaching tool for ourselves, but it also guides our behavior in the world. Just to make the point, I got to stop watching news again. But a day or two after Ms. Barr's, I don't even know how to describe it, another comedian said something, what I think was even more hurtful, about one of Donald Trump's children, and called her a word. Nobody will believe it in this culture, but I've never used that word, because to me it is just disgusting. But the interesting that the response was quite different towards her because of the ideology that because as a country, maybe as a world, we hate, we justify our hate because of another person's actions. We can apply that to his children, and so it's okay, even though there were some consequences that this woman had to face. But you know, that's okay because it follows my ideology. It's just as hateful and it's just as divisive, whether it fits with our view or not. And so there's another opportunity for learning. When we choose to ignore what's occurring in the world, especially this type of egregious and hurtful and hateful behavior, when we don't even want to look at it, when we just judge it and say, oh, it shouldn't be here, that person should be eliminated, we lose the learning opportunity because it's still here. And if we simply say, well, it shouldn't be here, we've lost a great opportunity because it's here. And if an awakened human being, and what you were describing so beautifully, as we develop understanding, we separate the need to approve of something, and we learn that we can accept it. Why? Because it's simply what's occurring. We don't have to lose our minds over something, and then we can have true effect. Think about the Buddha's life. There was a very severe and well-defined caste structure in India, and it's still, you know, mostly there today. It was defined very clearly who could hear even so-called spiritual teachings, and those teachings were only to be given to the two upper classes. And if you were an untouchable, you couldn't even look at someone like the Buddha or someone who might be a spiritual. You couldn't look at them. And if it was found that you were looked at this person, off with your head. That was a kind of hatred that was present during the Buddha's time. He said, no way. He says, everyone, every human being can come and listen to my teachings if they so desire. Upon his awakening, and so he was a living example, a constant teaching example of how to live free of all of that, free of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, which is what leads to that behavior. So excuse the speech, but he said it. You know, what a marvelous sangha we have, that these things come up and we can put them in the right context and maybe learn something ourselves too. Thank you. Kevin, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. John, good to see everybody. An interesting thing when Anthony was bringing it up, or you mentioned associations, that was sort of a theme there, and sort of that scalpel ideology or the refined mindfulness. I mean, a lot of associations, you know, you can't really annihilate. You know, you can't just destroy. Yeah. You have to use the scalpel and be skillful because... Yeah. It will be more stressful, the annihilation. I mean, you may have to see somebody professionally, or so you may walk down the street and see that person, but you may just be more skillful and not see them for certain things, right? You just see them when it arises, when you have to see them, but just to eliminate, for instance, a coworker or a colleague or a professional person, you know, I just can't talk to this person anymore. I mean, imagine how stressful that would be.
Yeah.
What that's rooted in, right? That's not living in the world, and
that's rooted in aversion.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting point on that. And then, you know, the fermentations are interesting. One particular thought that I'm trying to find context for is this thought that, and it may be more of a, it seems that, I don't want to sound closed off or label this, but it seems to be more of a male consciousness thought, and that thought is you hear it often in successful people when people who are doing things are confident. You're confident in what you're doing, and it borders on arrogance is the next step, but you have to be confident. You have to show up and really be confident in your life, and I've been struggling with that one. I mean, it's something that it comes from within, right? We have this self-talk and this self-doubt and confidence. It may just be fake confidence. You know, I'm confident about something. I just show up and I'm confident. People call you confident. They label you as confident. But
so how do you know it's authentic?
I mean, you know.
Because it has a foundation.
Right.
You have the courage of your convictions. Because they're grounded in something that itself is based in reality.
But
that's where the great freedom comes from, integrating the Eightfold Path.
So you have confidence in developing this wisdom, this path, but 99.9% of the people don't understand that. And So you're confident, and that comes back to right speech and the virtuous aspects. You don't say anything a lot of times. Maybe it's showing up in a meeting or whatever it is, and you're confident in that way. You say things with conviction, and you're quiet a lot. Maybe that's the way it works.
But people outside of this room would be surprised to know how quiet I am, because I don't talk much about anything. And in particular, I don't talk much about the Dhamma, because it's inappropriate. It's a good thing I have this venue where I'd never say anything. that idea of, so what do you do when you have to interact with a coworker or someone else on a daily basis or a relatively continual basis? That is where the refuge of the Dhamma comes in, because when we are enveloped in the refuge of the Dhamma, the Buddha would often talk about this. The world is a dangerous place without the Dhamma, but with the Dhamma we are protected. And so we can be with people without associating. So in that sense, say association doesn't mean that I'm happen to come across someone. It means that I'm identifying with someone. I've created an identity with that person or that group or that ideology. We learn to live in the world without being attached to the world. And that is the true meaning of refuge, and it's the true protection of refuge. So in that, and then we can be in any situation at all. The Buddha's life is such a great example of the situations that he'd find himself in, but he never lost his mind of equanimity, no matter what was occurring, whether it was attempts on his life, noticing battles going on, murderers coming after him on the road. He maintained a calm and peaceful mind, and he always acted appropriately to what's occurring. Sometimes it was that appropriate action was to describe a person to themselves, or using that as example, as this is a foolish thing. You're a foolish person acting this way. But he did that out of compassion, and he did it in the right setting. You know, again, he didn't seek out people to beat up. When they came to him and asked him a question, that was now his license to teach the Dhamma. But he wasn't an evangelist at any time in his life. And we shouldn't be either. People say, well, I noticed a change in you. What are you doing different? You know, you might just say, well, I've been meditating a little bit. I've been learning a little something of mindfulness. You know, which is really what I would say. You know, I see people that I haven't seen for many, many years. They say, wow, you're a lot different. They remember when I was a lot different. What are you doing different? I said, well, yeah, I meditate a little bit. And then if they're interested, I might talk a little more about it. But that's it. Again, thank you for bringing that up. Eva, good to see you. We've missed you.
It's very wonderful to be here and great to see everyone. Somebody says, hi, how you doing? What you been up to today? And then you start saying, and then you start listening, and then you start scoring points. Because I did 6 more things than this other person did, and I feel real pleasurable, and now I'm confident I could go back and do it. So I spend a lot of time the last months. What I've been experiencing is when I meditate that I can't concentrate, my mind is going all over the place, but I still make myself gently stay and try to go and to do it. Yeah. And I also find that what's happening a lot is that I am having a lot of arising of things and a lot of passing away of things, so that I'm sitting there going, you know, my body must be reacting because my mind is so constantly aware of, like, wow, I just said that. Oh, okay, let it go, you know, move on. Wow, I just said it again. You know, it's just amazing how it just keeps arising, and you gotta let it go, and it arises, and you gotta let it go, and you gotta be gentle. So I just keep repeating a lot of that, and I just do it over and over and over again.
Thank you for saying that, and it's great that you're able to practice the Dhamma that way, because that's the essence of it, noticing the arising and the passing away. I'm glad you're here this morning.
Thank you.
Mary, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good to be here. I'm doing well.
Good.
Sticking to my practice, which is very helpful in these times. And it helps me to stay level, basically.
Yeah.
Which is important. I mean, these particular series of teachings are just, there's just so much in there that can be applied to anyone. Anywhere. And it's just a shame more people don't look into it.
Thank you. You know, the Buddhist teachings put things in a useful perspective, you know, and so we don't have to be reacting because we understand it. We understand the nature and the results of ignorance, and we see it in other people. And I mean, that's the way I see things today. And, you know, again, I think I'm watching too much TV again, too much news, but I saw that the newsreel of Harvey Weinstein doing the perp walk. And, you know, on one hand, hey, boy, he's hurt so many people. But you look at this man, I mean, he is the epitome of dukkha, isn't he? Just I don't think I've ever saw an emotionally more sadder, if I can use a word, human being. And so it's possible to have compassion for, and we must have compassion for people like that if we're going to get to the root of the problem. Anger doesn't get us there anymore. It just never did. It doesn't work. So again, we don't approve of what people like that do, but we accept it because it's what's occurring in our world. And we can't just put it on individuals, can we? Again, excuse the speech. Diane, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. My experience with meditation has taken me to a lot of dark places. And in that, in those corners and crevices of my life and my mind is, for me, where compassion comes from, because there isn't, I mean, I have at one time wanted to murder someone. I have had great hate.
It wasn't me, was it?
Mm-hmm. Well, every now and then you...
That's it?
every time I try to be really confident, or throughout my life, I mean, this is all what has for me come up in meditation. There are times when I have been, you know, really super confident, and then when I what meditation reveals is a certain arrogance, a superiority, and not any, you know, not any compassion. And I need to, I mean, this is to me the importance of the Dhamma and the meditation, to look within and see myself as I truly am. And there's cause for doubt, and there's cause for humility in me. And I keep, or the other day I asked Matt, how do you teach children this? And Matt said, well, you don't need to teach children, they know. And there was a young man there around 21 years old or something at that meeting, in that class. And I mean, I remembered in my childhood times when I wanted my parents to, I really did this. I wanted them to slam me up against the wall and make me behave. And they didn't. And what I'm realizing, like through all of these teachings, is it's my personal responsibility. It wasn't my parents. And I did know what was right and wrong, and I chose illly, is that a word?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes.
Can be.
And so not an easy path, and it is not for the faint-hearted, and it kind of keeps me, well, especially when I meditate. When I don't meditate, I don't stay as grounded, and I get in my head, and when I do meditate, I am more grounded. I think one of the other parts of this where what I am in my course of time of life is I don't know what is going to happen. I don't know really what to do with my life right now. I don't know. And staying in that I don't know phase or whatever it is, state of being or something like that, is, especially in the world, is not easy. And my son, you know, I mean, there are people in my life who really don't like that I don't know. But in surrendering to it, there's almost a freedom that comes of letting, you know, what is be, and it kind of blows out of the water the need to be. I think the word competency could be exchanged a little bit with integrity. I would rather have integrity than the necessity of competency. And maybe that's part of the scaffolding thing that the person does. But it's not, life is messy, but what I'm finding is, and I don't know whether this is just because I'm old or what, you know how old people, you think that they're always going back to childhood or something like that? But I think that's when older people start to realize, I knew it once. I knew. I really knew. And it was okay. And the knowing is the just pure innocence. And with a wisdom, and I kind of think this because of what I think, some, and what I believe, but when we come from like the spirit world, there is that wisdom still there. And we can lose it or keep it or find it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The a life well integrated with the Eightfold Path is a life that we're expressing our highest level of competency. So we shouldn't be too concerned about being confident. We should be concerned about developing wisdom. And that, you know, that teaching a child, I've been fortunate that I've had a few young people as individual students, and I always start by right speech, because a kid, Eva, so good to see you this morning.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Bye. See ya.
Yeah, we'll be done after this next quick speech. So while I ask a 12 or 14 or 16-year-old, did you ever notice when you're with a friend of yours and you're talking about another friend that's not there, that it often makes you feel unhappy? And almost to a kid, they'll say, yeah, I noticed that. Because now they're learning the effects of their speech, there is an effect to it, and that it affects the way they feel about themselves and other people. And so immediately they have a visceral engagement with the Dhamma that way. And kids understand that right away. They understand that they can change their behavior and change how they experience the world, because that's what it's about. It works very well. We went on a little bit longer today, but I'd like to thank you for staying with me. We'll finish with the Metta Sutta. The only announcement is it's next Saturday that the Wan Dharma Center is having a concert from the native, I can't remember what it's called, the Four Nations Ensemble. And so if anybody wants to go, let me know and we'll go up. It doesn't appear like anybody wants to do the drive that day, and that's okay. I think
what's the Four Nations? Is that Native American or?
Yeah.
Okay.
No. So
is it Native American music?
It looks like no, it's not Native American music as far as I can tell. It looks like symphony, orchestral type of music. There's four different musicians that are part of this group. They're very, very good. But again, it's a, when we talked about it up on retreat, you know, at least I did, I wasn't really thinking that it's, you know, it's a 3-hour ride up, 3-hour ride back. So it's kind of a long day. But if anybody wants to go online or here, let me know and we'll put it together. Let's finish with meta, as we always do. As soon as I can find it. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body, your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on meta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, content and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.